Welcome to Live Longer World, a podcast where we unite to boost longevity and fight aging. All resources and premium member benefits are found at livelongerworld.com. Now, on to today's episode. Today's guest is Dr. Peter Adams, who is an expert in the biology of aging and cancer. In today's episode, you will learn about cellular senescence and its dual role in protecting against cancer, but also causing tissue aging. We'll also hear about the role of senolytic drugs to protect against age-associated cellular senescence, and the connection between the mitochondria and cellular senescence. And finally, you'll hear about the development theory of aging, the fact that aging might begin in the womb itself. With that, I hope you enjoy the conversation today.
Hi, Dr. Adams, and welcome to the Live Longer World podcast.
Hi, happy to be here, Asta. Thanks. Watched a lot of your videos. I really like them.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So, Dr. Adams, your work focuses a lot on the epigenetics of cellular senescence, cancer, and aging. Maybe we can begin by you explaining what is cellular senescence, because that's something that's been implicated in aging a bunch of times. It keeps coming up. So if you can explain what it is, and also perhaps the dual role it plays, because it has a positive function, but then over time with age, it starts becoming more negative. So, yeah.
So I guess, cellular senescence was first described by Leonard Hayflick and Paul Moorhead back in the 1960s as really a tissue culture phenomenon. They were growing normal human fibroblasts, primary fibroblasts, we call them, in a dish. And what they noticed was that after a certain number of population doublings, about 60 population doublings, these cells would just stop growing. And they acquired this, large, flat, kind of vacuolated phenotype as well. So they call this, this proliferation arrest as cellular senescence. And at the time, I think it was quite unusual because at the time, most people were working with cancer cells in culture. And cancer cells, the thing about cancer cells is they will basically grow forever. They're so-called immortal. So this proliferation arrest on the part of these normal primary human cells was quite unusual. And I think even then, Leonard kind of noted at the time that, this proliferation arrest, this kind of, limit on proliferative capacity might be something which, works as, an anti-cancer mechanism, okay? So it would stop potential cancer cells from proliferating uncontrollably. And I think he also noted that it might also, put a limit on tissue regeneration and therefore lead to tissue aging. Okay, so two really insightful observations or predictions. Because I think now there's very good evidence for both of those. I think for a long time, senescence remained as a tissue culture phenomenon. And I think probably back in the 1990s, there was a lot of debate as to whether it was, physiologically relevant or whether it was just a tissue culture artifact. Something that I think happened about, the 1990s and the early 2000s was that, I think, primarily Judy Campisi, and I think, followed by Daniel Paper and Hazus Gill, showed that, senescent cells also have this secreted inflammatory phenotype, okay, which Judy called the senescence-associated secretory phenotype. So this is an inflammatory phenotype whereby the senescent cells will secrete, a lot of different inflammatory cytokines and chemokines and other things. So therefore, they have the potential to interact with their neighbors and also to regulate the immune system. Okay, so when I think about senescence, I think as primarily of two two phenotypes, okay? There's this proliferation arrest, whereby the cells stop growing. But then there's also this inflammatory phenotype, or the SASP, senescence-associated secretory phenotype. But even at that point, I mean, there was still debate as to whether senescence, you know, was something which, you know, happened in vivo physiologically, or whether it, you know, was it still this just this tissue culture artifact. But for me, you know, the big change came, I think, in about 2005, when there was a flurry of papers showing that senescence could be observed in vivo, in both humans and mice, and particularly in the context of, oncogene activation. Okay, so it was shown that in these particular circumstances, you know, in cells with activated oncogenes, that senescent cells can accumulate in vivo. So actually, one of the best examples of that is these, moles, benign human nevi, okay, which I think we all, not sure if I have one handy to show, but you know, we all have moles, okay. And what moles are thought to be is the brown pigment comes from the senescent melanocyte, the senescent cells. Okay, they're actually melanocytes, which is why they are brown. And the reason that they are senescent is because they contain an activated oncogene. And so this oncogene causes a proliferative expansion, but eventually the cells will arrest to form this cluster of cells, of senescent cells, or senescent melanocytes. Okay, so that was one of the best demonstrations of senescent cells in, or it's still kind of the paradigm for senescent cells in vivo in humans, I think. So then, you know, at that point we kind of knew, we kind of characterized the phenotype, proliferation arrest, and SASP. We knew that senescent cells are found in vivo. And since then, I would say that there's a lot of fantastic work being done by many labs, both, you know, defining the role of senescence as Leonard predicted, okay, in both prevention of cancer, but also as a driver of aging. I've mentioned, I mean, in terms of the things that cause senescence, like I said, that Leonard initially, you know, noticed it just through, you know, growing cells in culture. I've also mentioned that, you know, senescence can be caused by activated oncogenes, and for example, in human nevi. Okay, so actually, there are thought to be, you know, various different triggers of senescence. One is so that what Leonard was observing was partly. The trigger there was in large part shortening of telomeres. Okay, so as the cells were growing in culture, the telomeres are getting shorter, and eventually the telomeres get so short as to activate a DNA damage response, and that induced senescence. In the case of oncogenes that I mentioned, I mean, oncogenes, so an oncogene is a, you know, a mutated gene which has the capability to promote cancer. And so, you know, cancers are characterized by having these activated oncogenes. But what happens is if a cell acquires, and this is the case in melanocytes within nevi, okay, if a cell acquires just a single oncogene, okay, then it's actually pretty good at protecting itself from that. And so what will happen is that the cell will sense this activated oncogene, and it, eventually it will stop growing and enter this senescent state. Okay, and the reason oncogenes do that is again thought to be in part because they cause DNA damage. And then there's other types of DNA damage and other cell stresses which can also cause senescence. So we know that, you know, senescence is caused by these various different molecular triggers often associated with DNA damage that causes senescence. Senescence is associated with these two key phenotypes, the proliferation arrest and the inflammation. And we know that occurs in vivo, and as I say, we know that it on the one hand, it prevents cancer. That's what it's doing in nevi. But on the other hand, you know, we also now know that it promotes tissue aging. And so in, you know, in more recent years, there's been a lot of work done on the, you know, the aging side of things. Okay, so for example, mouse models have been generated, for example, by Jan van Deursen and Darren Baker and Judy Cambisi. And these are mouse models where you can actually use sophisticated genetic strategies to eliminate senescent cells from a tissue. Okay, and what's been shown that when you do that, when you get rid of senescent cells from the tissue of a mouse, then it can promote healthy aging of those tissues, and it can even promote, you know, extended lifespan and health span of the mice. And, you know, not only now can that be done, you know, using these sophisticated genetic strategies, but it can also be done with drugs. Mm-hmm. Okay, these are these so-called senolytic drugs. And, you know, a number of these drugs have also been shown to improve, you know, health span and lifespan of mice and suppress specific pathologies of aging. Okay, so that's why, you know, there's a lot of excitement in the senescence field now about actually, you know, targeting senescent cells in human tissues for the benefit of, you know, preventing specific pathologies of aging, perhaps promoting healthy aging and you know, if you believe this is a good thing, actually extending lifespan. Okay, it's a different issue. I'm more in the camp that what we need to do here is to extend healthy human lifespan and not necessarily extend overall lifespan. But you know, whichever camp you're in, there's you know, there is quite a bit of excitement about senolytics in that regard. And some of these molecules are now being, you know, dasatinib and quercetin, for example, is one combination senolytic, which is, you know, I mean, these are essentially, you know, they're either natural compounds or compounds which have been extensively tested in humans. And so, you know, that it's relatively easy to test them in the clinic against specific pathologies. I think, like, you know, chronic kidney disease, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis and osteoarthritis, for example, are some of the conditions that these drugs are being tested against. And there's some, you know, it's very early days. I wouldn't say that, you know, full data is actually in, but there's some encouraging preliminary data.
Fantastic. I'm going to come back to senolytics and ask you a few questions on that. I think there were a few listeners who had questions on that. But before that, on the point of mole, so I have a mole right here.
Yeah.
Is that like an oncogene suppression? What is that then?
Yeah, so that,
since I was young.
Right. Yes. So the, you know, the kind of the conventional view of that would be that that, you know, the melanocytes within that mole, all of them will contain either a, you know, typically one of two oncogenes. Okay, it's either an activated BRAF oncogene or an activated RAS oncogene. Okay, these are two oncogenes which are actually in the same pathway. BRAF activates RAS. Okay, so it kind of drives this signaling pathway, which can promote cell proliferation. But if you get too much of it, it can actually promote cancer. Okay, so those melanocytes would have an activated BRAF or NRAS oncogene. You can't tell unless you take the DNA out and sequence it. You can't really tell, but they'll probably have one of those two, but because of that oncogene-induced senescence, these cells are actually in this, you know, now in this kind of stable proliferation arrest, and, you know, they'll probably be like that for the, you know, for the rest of your life. Okay, I mean, occasionally moles can, you know, they can progress to melanoma, so which is why, you know, if you have a mole and you see a change in shape or a change in size or it gets inflamed or whatever, you should definitely go and see a doctor, and typically they'll just remove it and it's not a problem. They are senescent melanocytes in that mole. That's the dogma. Okay, we've actually published a few papers in my lab suggesting we're not sure it's totally quite that simple. Okay, we don't necessarily see melanocytes within a nevus as being bona fide senescence, but actually more of a kind of an aberrant form of senescence. We actually think that the reason they expand to the point that they do so that you can actually see them is because the senescence program is somewhat impaired. Okay, so they actually get to proliferate to a point where you can see them. And actually, the reason we think that they are the senescence program is impaired is actually related to an interesting biology of moles, which is that actually most people are actually born with their moles, right, or they are acquired during early development in young children. Okay, so we think that there is a developmental component to it as well through what's known as activated Wnt signaling, which is basically a growth factor pathway. And so that is quite active during early development of melanocytes. And so we think that is, you know, helping to slow down the senescence program, which is why these moles get to be as big as they do. Okay. And there's a few other kind of, you know, funny quirks about them. They're really interesting things. But yeah, I mean, I didn't realize until I had two daughters that how, you know, noticeable it is that, you know, moles are basically, you know, acquired, you know, as I say, born with them, or they're acquired in young children. I mean, I remember my first daughter when she was born, I think she had one, okay, because I was working on moles at the time, so I counted it, it was just one, but, you know, now she has dozens, okay, and so these all grew during childhood and adolescence, but, you know, generally adults don't acquire more moles. I think it's pretty rare, okay, once we reach adulthood, we kind of have our complement of moles, I think.
But then for people who have moles, should they be worried that those senescent cells in that area could be releasing SASP that you just spoke about, or the secretory phenotype?
Yes, you know, so that's another quirk of moles is that, you know, I mean, they don't really, you know, as a, you know, one view of senescence is that the SASP, and there is evidence for this from, you know, mouse models, okay, that the SASP will promote clearance of senescent cells by the immune system. Mm. Okay. But that, you know, that very rarely happens with moles. Okay. And moles I don't think moles have much of a SASP. So that is in my mind, another reason why the melanocytes within a nevus are a little bit aberrant and probably aren't really, you know, a bona fide senescence. But then even talking about bona fide senescence gets kind of problematic, okay, because as you probably know, there isn't an accepted single definition of a senescent cell, okay? It's really kind of a spectrum of phenotypes. So I think, you know, the melanocytes within a nevus are on that spectrum, but they're a little bit of a variation of it compared to, you know, other senescent cells which have a proliferation arrest and a SASP. And the other thing that varies is that, I mean, it used to be thought that senescence is something which just happens to proliferating cells, okay, and that's something that came out of Leonard Hayflick's work, okay, and he was studying proliferating cells in culture, so for a long time people thought, well, you know, senescence is just something that happens to proliferating cells, but now I think there's a lot of evidence from, you know, that non-proliferating cells, for example, including neurons and cardiomyocytes, and even, you know, melanocytes in normal human skin, which are typically, you know, non-proliferating, that these non-proliferating cells can also acquire a senescent-like phenotype. Okay, so in that case, what happens is they don't stop proliferating because they're not proliferating in the first place, but they will acquire the inflammatory phenotype. And that can be, you know, that then can drive the chronic inflammation which is associated with senescence.
I see. And that's quite an interesting point.
Yeah, I guess what I didn't say is I didn't comment much about how senescent cells are thought to promote aging. I think, you know, part of it is probably, for example, the proliferation arrest that can, you know, prevent cell renewal and tissue regeneration. The inflammatory phenotype can drive chronic inflammation or so-called inflammaging. And there's also evidence that, you know, the senescent state will also prevent the normal differentiation of progenitor cells. Okay, so there's probably a bunch of ways that senescent cells can contribute to tissue aging by preventing proliferation, promoting inflammation, and preventing, you know, normal differentiation.
Okay. Yeah. So you mentioned senolytics then, which is helpful in clearing away the senescent cells and, you know, could be quite promising in increasing maybe health span at least. And you mentioned a few of them like quercetin. So I guess what is your take on senolytics? I know some of the concerns are what age should you be taking them or what's the right dosage or are they really just targeting senescent cells or would they be targeting potentially good cells as well? So what's your view on senolytics so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of those are really complex questions. You know, there's probably people who could give you more informed answers than me. You know, I guess I would say that, though, that really, you know, we're not going to have answers to all those questions about, you know, specificity for normal cells versus senescent cells and good and bad consequences of removing senescent cells, etc. You know, it's going to take a long time to get answers to all of those questions. And I think, you know, I think instead, you know, probably the approach that's being taken is just to be, you know, kind of empirical about it. Okay, let's just test these, you know, these senolytics. I think, you know, at the moment we're testing drugs which have already been extensively tested in humans. We know their toxicity profile, and they are being tested against, you know, specific pathologies of aging. Okay, we're not giving them to a bunch of, you know, 40 or 50 year old very healthy people and saying, well, you know, take this for the next 20 or 30 years. Okay, they're being tested against specific pathologies, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, osteoarthritis, etc. You know, I think presumably, and you know, under, you know, well controlled, as in, you know, close observation circumstances, you know, limited doses, limited durations, etc. And let's just see if they are of benefit to these specific pathologies of aging, which are already, you know, detrimental pathologies in their own right. And then, you know, before, and then if the results from those studies are encouraging, then we can, you know, we can move on to other things. But so I think, you know, I think everybody agrees that it's, we, you know, we're not, at least everybody who I know who kind of works on senescent cells, I don't think anyone really advocates that, you know, healthy middle-aged people should be taking senolytics.
Right. I ask because, you know, there are so many experimenters out there and people don't want to wait for years and years for some of these studies to come out. You know, when they're like in their 50s, decently healthy, of course, but of course you're not nowhere as close to where you were when you were in your 20s and you want to test some of these. So I think, in fact, this question came from one of my listeners who was wondering, well, is it bad to be taking too much of it and too often? And I think he's just like a healthy middle-aged person. So yeah, and I think people are experimenting with it as well. So it's like, for those who are, what do you think they should be wary about at least?
Well, I think, you know, the potential long-term consequences, the potential issues of you know, not taking the right dose. Okay, I mean, most things in biology are very, you know, dose dependent. You know, typically things, you know, have this, you know, things will often have this kind of shape. Okay, you know, they may get better up to a certain dose, you get an optimum, and then things start to become detrimental. Okay. And that's the case for a lot of things in biology. Okay. So, you know, I don't know that we really know what that optimum dose is for most of these things. You know, the extrapolations from, you know, from mice, obviously, you know, the extrapolations that we can make from mice are limited. So, you know, I think for some of these things, you know, I mean, my understanding is that, I mean, that's, you know, some of these candidate interventions, there is good human data on, you know, toxicity profiles, dose responses, etc. So I think for some of these things, if, you know, if you're kind of well informed and you can interpret that data, you can probably, make an make a good an informed decision. I haven't looked into any of that data. Okay, it's not something that I don't take anything.
Yeah. No, it's always very interesting because when I talk to scientists, most of them, in fact, are not really taking any of these supplements, and then there's this whole group of consumers out there who are just so eager to start taking a lot of these supplements. And I still say it's like, yeah, I mean, a lot of the data is not out there. So if you're taking them, it's kind of based on your own risk and based on what you've studied from the limited studies that are there.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a bit about some of your work on liver cancer, actually, you've just started some of the work. I know you recently got a grant for that, so congrats on that from the NIH.
Yeah.
So that's to study liver cancer and aging more specifically. To start, I guess I'm curious, why did you pick liver cancer?
Yeah, good. That's a good question. I mean, I guess it's a little bit pragmatic. Partly because, when we want to study cancer the way that cancer is typically studied, okay, in mouse models is using genetically modified mice. So mice which, have been engineered to have specific oncogenes or to inactivate specific tumor suppressors, mm-hmm. okay? And typically what's done is that these mice are generated, and then when the mice are still young, these oncogenes and tumor suppressors are switched, on or off, okay? And typically then the mouse gets cancer pretty quickly, okay? Often in weeks or months, okay? So this completely ignores the role of aging in the kind of genesis of the disease. And yet, for most adult human cancers, age is the biggest single risk factor. Okay, so what we wanted to do was specifically look at, well, what's the role of aging in development of cancer? Why is it that, most cancers increase with age and, very common in old people, and most cancers are very rare in young people, with some exceptions, okay? I mean, there are some childhood leukemias, things like retinoblastoma, et cetera, which tend to, hit young people. But, these are kind of, in my mind, fundamentally different types of disease, okay? So most of the common human cancers, colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, liver cancer, these are cancers of older people. So that was what we wanted to model. The trouble is that if you take the typical genetically modified mice, then you generate these mice, and then you've got your mice, but now you have to wait 2 years for them to get old before you can, switch on the oncogenes to actually do the experiment. Okay. So, like everybody else, we don't really want to do that. It's very time consuming and costly. Okay. So the strategy that we wanted to take was to take, young and old mice, young and old wild type mice. Okay. And getting old wild type mice is relatively straightforward. Okay. We actually have a colony ourselves, or we can get them from the NIA for free, because we have NIA grants. So we can get these young and old mice, but these are wild type mice, okay? They don't have any of these oncogenes or tumor suppressors engineered into their genome. But what we can now do is we use viruses to deliver the oncogenes or the tumor suppressors to the young mice and the wild type mice, and we compare the effects of, well, what happens if we deliver an oncogene to a young mouse versus an old mouse. Okay, so that's a big part of the approach that we're trying, and it's generating some very interesting results. But going back to your question of, well, why liver cancer? Okay, so the liver is quite easy to manipulate in that way. Okay, so it's quite easy to deliver viruses to a mouse and put these oncogenes into the liver. It's much easier to do it in the liver than it is, for example, in some other tissues like the pancreas or even many tissues. We have some models. We're doing similar experiments with the mouse mammary gland as well as a model for breast cancer. But But the challenge is the virus delivery strategies there are a bit more tricky. So that was a bit part of it. Okay, just that it was a tractable model that we could manipulate. There's some other advantage. I mean, the liver is relatively homogeneous in terms of cell types. Okay, it's about 80% hepatocytes, so you can get a relatively pure population of cells. Okay, we purify the hepatocytes from the liver, so we know what cells that we're dealing with. Okay, as opposed to dealing with the complexities of a whole tissue. Okay, so that's another advantage. And it just turns out that, the progression of liver cancer is also very interesting, okay? I mean, it starts off with, perhaps a steatotic or a fatty liver, okay? That then might become inflamed in non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And then you get fibrosis and cirrhosis. And so this kind of progression through kind of metabolic changes, inflammatory changes, it's kind of a very interesting disease progression, which we wanted to understand more about that. But to be honest with you, a big part of it was just the practicalities of working with the liver over some other tissues.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the statements actually that I think stood out to me was that liver cancer rates in the United States are lower than the rest of the world. I'm just curious, do you know why that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's due to, in some parts of the world, it's a lot higher due to HCV, so hepatitis virus. That's a lot higher in other, some other parts of the world than in the US. But it's a big concern in the US because, in the US, two of the major risk factors for liver cancer are age, obviously, as I've mentioned, but also obesity. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so as, populations get older and fatter, rates of liver cancer are projected to increase dramatically. And still, the cure rates for liver cancer are not good. So it's not one of the biggest killers at the moment, but certainly it's definitely on the rise and is projected to be a big problem.
Yeah, especially with the poor diets, it also leads to non-alcoholic fatty liver diseases.
Right.
So one of your hypotheses is that, you'll be working on something called the interferon signaling, which is a natural part of the immune system you mentioned. Maybe you can talk about what is the signaling pathway and what is its connection with the immune system, and I guess something it's going awry with age. So what's going wrong with age?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the interferon pathway is, best known as being a pathway that responds to virus infection, okay, and also other kind of related types of other types of molecular damage, okay, these in particular viruses and foreign nucleic acids, foreign DNAs in the cell, they can activate, the interferon pathways. In terms of cancer, it's best known, I think, as, being tumor suppressive. Okay. So it's thought to recruit immune cells, which can, eliminate, potential cancer cells. Okay. But what we've noticed in the old liver is that there is this, what appears to be a kind of chronic activation of it, a chronic low level activation of interferon signaling. And, there is some evidence that a chronic low level activation of interferon signaling can actually, switch from being a beneficial thing to actually being detrimental. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what I was saying earlier about, the doses of senolytics and other drugs, okay, they might be good, but but at certain doses or on, you know, long-term treatment, they might switch to being bad. Okay, because everything in biology is kind of, you know, very, very finely balanced. Okay, and if you tip things, you know, too far one direction, it can go from being beneficial to detrimental. And that seems to be the case with chronic interferon signaling. Okay, is that, you know, this chronic interferon signaling, which we appears to accumulate with aging, can actually, instead of activating the immune system, can then actually dampen the immune system. Okay, and it perhaps does that because, you know, there's only so much immune activation that the body wants. Okay, and it eventually maybe that's sensed as being, you know, a chronic activation is sensed as being a bad thing. So then, you know, the system kind of, you know, puts itself into reverse. Okay, and so instead of being immune activating and getting rid of potential cancer cells, it can actually do the opposite, okay, and prevent the immune system from eliminating potential cancer cells. And so that's one hypothesis that we have in the old liver, okay, is that this chronic low-level activation of interferon signaling will dampen down the immune system, leading to so-called immune suppression. And that allows, you know, these potential cancer cells, they're not cancer cells yet, okay, but they're potential cancer cells, which might otherwise be removed by the immune system. It allows those cells to, you know, to persist. And then increase the risk of cancer in the old tissue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So one other hypothesis you have is studying the mitochondria. And I think you've already studied a lot of this with your work, that showing the connection between mitochondrial dysfunction and increase in SASP maybe. So what is the connection between mitochondria and cellular senescence?
So we know that in senescent cells, the mitochondria are dysfunctional. Okay, so they have abnormal morphology, and if we look at kind of, you know, various bioenergetic parameters of mitochondria in senescent cells, it doesn't look as if they are, you know, functioning efficiently or properly. And that, you know, that's been known for quite a while. I guess the surprise was to us was that, you know, these dysfunctional mitochondria might actually be, you know, promoting aspects of the senescent phenotype. So you know, one way of looking at it, but initially might be that, well, yeah, okay, the mitochondria are dysfunctional, that's just a consequence of senescence. Okay, but in actual fact, we think in some respects it's the opposite. Okay, the dysfunctional mitochondria are actually sending a signal into the nucleus of the cell, and the mitochondria are actually telling the nucleus what to do. Okay, and that's, you know, that's kind of the opposite for how we, you know, we think about a lot of things in biology. We normally think that the high school we're taught that, you know, the nucleus is kind of a control center of the cell, and the nucleus tells everything else what to do. But I think what's becoming apparent is, and this isn't just mitochondria in senescence, I think it's all organelles in, you know, many different biological contexts, but, you know, there's it's much more of a two-way communication. Okay, but, you know, what we found in senescent cells is that these mitochondria are sending a signal to the nucleus, and what that then does is it causes the nucleus to eject bits of DNA into the cytoplasm of the cell. And then that cytoplasm, in that DNA in the cytoplasm, okay, then that's, you know, that's somewhat reminiscent of a virus. Okay, I mentioned and as I mentioned earlier, you know, viruses can be sensed by the interferon pathway. Okay, mm-hmm. So then we think there's this whole connection going from mitochondria sending a signal to the nucleus, expelling bits of DNA into the cytoplasm, activating the interferon pathway and other inflammatory pathways, and and, you know, potentially all this immune suppression that I just mentioned to you. So you know, by that view, these mitochondria are really kind of central controllers of the senescent phenotype, you know, an inflammatory phenotype. They're not just kind of, you know, passive bystanders.
Interesting. So in terms of therapies, then maybe targeting the mitochondria could also help with senescent cell clearance.
Yeah. So we've as kind of proof of principle, we've identified, you know, a number of small molecules which will inhibit, you know, components of this pathway, including, you know, acting, we think, at the mitochondria. And we're actively screening for, you know, other drugs which will also do this and intervene, you know, in this pathway or improve mitochondria function and therefore suppress the inflammatory phenotype of senescent cells, which, as I've said to you, can be, you know, damaging in various different ways.
What are some of the molecules what you've already found?
So at the moment, most of them, we've published, for example, with so-called junk inhibitors, inhibitors of a specific signaling kinase, HDAC inhibitors, which affect, you know, nuclear chromatin, and then also some inhibitors of DNA repair pathways. So all of these different types of inhibitor. I mean, these we found these through kind of hypothesis-driven approaches, but we're now doing unbiased screens to try and find, you know, novel drugs, including, you know, things which, you know, for example, natural compounds which would be, you know, easier to administer to, you know, to humans for as candidate healthy aging interventions. You know,
fantastic.
Like quercetin, for example.
Right. Yeah. No, I look forward to that. In terms of natural compounds, I guess, then for the mitochondria specifically, are you aware if some of the mitochondria ones like urolithin A or CoQ10, if they actually help in terms of clearing away senescent cells too?
No, we keep, that's a really good idea. And I've exchanged a bunch of emails with, you know, we keep talking about that in the lab to test some of these, you know, specific compounds, and we haven't got round to doing it yet. I think what we should do is we should incorporate, you know, get a library of these things together and put them into the screens that we're doing. Because you're right, there's certainly some kind of interesting, you know, candidate molecules out there as well.
Right. I'm always so intrigued by how biology is so interrelated. One thing ends up affecting multiple different things.
That's the wonder and the complexity of biology. Yeah, it's just amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So maybe going a little more technical for a bit, I know you've coined this term chromostasis, which I guess more high level basically means epigenetic stability.
And
you talk about how, you know, the stable epigenome suppresses cancer and suppresses aging, but I guess over time it becomes unstable. Or maybe if you can talk to the relationship between loss and stability of the epigenome and aging.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of basically comes from the idea that, you know, the epigenome or chromatin, okay, is not fixed. You know, we typically think of DNA sequence, you know, AGCT as being, you know, that sequence is fixed, okay, apart from, you know, mutations and other types of alteration to the DNA maybe. But you know, we think of the DNA sequence as fundamentally being fixed, but chromatin, the epigenome, is not like that, okay? It's much more plastic and dynamic. Okay, so what I mean by chromatin, and I use chromatin and epigenome interchangeably. A lot of people don't like that, but I don't think we need to make the distinction here. What I mean by chromatin in the epigenome is the way that the DNA is folded up inside the nucleus. Okay, so you have the strand of DNA. It's wrapped around proteins to form these so-called nucleosomes. Those nucleosomes can be modified on the DNA. For example, the DNA methylation that Morgan studies. I saw your wonderful interview with Morgan. So the DNA methylation, there's also, you know, modifications of the histones. And then all this is, again, further folded and ultimately compacted into the nucleus, okay? And it's this really complex mixture that makes up chromatin or the epigenome. As I say, that's not completely fixed, okay? Because every time a gene is converted into RNA to express that gene to ultimately make that protein, you know, that gene has to be unfolded. We also know that DNA replication leads to unfolding and then refolding of the chromatin. DNA repair involves unfolding and refolding. So basically everything that happens to chromatin involves, you know, this kind of unfolding and refolding. Okay, mm-hmm. So in other words, then chromatin is very plastic, okay? It's opening, it's breathing all the time. And so therefore we think that, you know, chromatin is not, is more in this kind of steady state, okay? It more of a, it requires a certain level of homeostasis, okay? So that's where chromostasis comes from. It's basically chromatin homeostasis, okay? And that's actually borrowing from another expression in the aging field, proteostasis, okay? Which basically means the same thing, which is kind of, you know, protein homeostasis, okay? Keeping proteins in the, you know, which are, you know, kind of dynamic and plastic, keeping them kind of where they're meant to be. And so because it's dynamic and plastic, you know, we think that therefore it's prone to change over time. Okay. And actually, you know, the DNA methylation clock is a perfect example of that. Okay. So the clock obviously ticks with age, you know, through the gain and loss of these DNA methylations. And that, you know, that loss, that gain and loss of methylation, that ticking of the clock is a, you know, an example of this change with age, which, you know, is predicted from the fact that chromatin is not completely fixed. You know, I guess, so then we take it one step further and we reason that, well, if chromatin is changing with age, ultimately that's going to impact on, you know, cell phenotype and function. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because what, you know, what really defines cells, okay, what makes a neuron different from a cardiomyocyte, a heart cell, their DNA sequence is essentially identical, but what makes those two cells different is their chromatin, okay, right. the way the DNA is packaged up. So if this chromatin is so important for cell identity, and yet it's changing with age, then at some point that's, you know, that has the potential to change cell phenotype, okay, and that would be a really bad thing. Okay, and so, you know, the ultimate example of this, I think, is, you know, neurons and cardiomyocytes, okay? So many of the neurons in our brains, I mean, they're with us for the whole of our lives, okay, 80 or 90 years. So, you know, in my mind, you know, really kind of important question is, you know, how does a neuron remain as a neuron for 90 years? Okay, I think that's really amazing. And so that's
the neurons. There are
stem cells in the brain, so there is some turnover of cells in the brain, but it's very slow. It doesn't, as I understand it, it doesn't affect all populations of cells in the brain. And when people have done these kind of radioisotope label, I mean, this is, I think it's been linked to, for example, I'm not sure whether it's linked to, well, I can't remember, I won't attempt to say how it's been done, but the study's been done trying to age neurons in the brain, okay, and it's been concluded that a significant proportion of the neurons in our brains are, you know, we are born with those neurons, okay, so those neurons are with us for our entire lives, and yet, you know, and I think the same is true of cardiomyocytes. For other tissues which are turning over more quickly, it's not true. Okay. But for these long-lived, very slowly dividing tissues, these cells live for a very long time. So, you know, if these neurons have this dynamic chromatin, which is, you know, turning over and breathing and opening and closing, well, you know, how does that neuron stay as a neuron for 90 years? Okay, I don't think we know the answer to that question. So the whole chromostasis idea is really meant to be just a way of kind of conceptualizing that. What are the mechanisms by which a cell stabilizes its chromatin or its epigenome so as to be able to maintain its phenotype. Okay, and another way of putting it is, you know, how does a cell perhaps slow down the clicking, the ticking of the clock?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, Morgan talked about how the clock can tick, you know, faster, and that might lead to an increase in biological age, and that can be detrimental. But, you know, so to what extent can the cell control that rate of ticking and therefore, you know, prevent it ticking so fast that, you know, that the function deteriorates, if, you know, too early? And, you know, I would imagine, for example, that, I mean, these mechanisms are, for example, more efficient in long-lived human cells than in mouse cells. Okay, so, you know, mouse cells only live for a couple of years, but mm-hmm. you know, human neurons can live for 90 years. So these mechanisms are probably, you know, more sophisticated, you know, more efficient in human cells. But anyway, by chromostasis, we're trying to understand what those mechanisms are.
I see. So have we identified any of these mechanisms? Because I know you've talked about some of these epigenetic regulators, one of them being HERA, I believe.
It was some studies that we did with this histone chaperone HERA in senescent cells, which kind of, you know, led to this idea, because what we found was that in senescent cells that this HERA chaperone is leading to, you know, kind of turnover of was controlling the turnover of nucleosomes, the histones which make up the nucleosomes. So we reasoned that, you know, HERA was likely to impact on this process. But I wouldn't say yet we have any. I mean, there is some evidence, not from us, but there is some evidence that if you inactivate HERA, for example, in the muscle, okay, the muscle is another, you know, is again made up of long-lived, slowly dividing cells, these myocytes and myotubes, okay, muscle turns over very slowly, so those cells are also very long-lived. And there is evidence that if you inactivate HERA in the muscle, then that does lead to kind of, you know, it leads to a kind of failure of lineage maintenance. Okay, so by that view, yes, HERA is working in, you know, to promote chromostasis in the muscle, I would say. That would be one way of interpreting those data.
Interesting. What about, are there any other mechanisms?
No, I mean, I would speculate, for example, that, you know, that mechanisms involved in, you know, regulating DNA methylation and the DNA methylation clock are also, you know, involved in this, but mm-hmm. you know, I guess the experiments that need to be done to really, you know, confirm this are to inactivate the candidate genes of interest, okay, for example in a mouse, and show that the inactivating that gene leads to a degeneration of the chromatin with age, and also a, you know, degeneration and phenotype and function of the cells. And so, you know, there aren't that many studies describing that kind of thing. As I say, HERA is, you know, fits into that category, but I'm having trouble thinking of anything else at the moment. These are really, you know, basically what you have to do is you have to inactivate your gene of interest, which has no, you know, the prediction is it has no consequence in a young mouse, okay, and then you have to age that mouse for a couple of years in anticipation of getting a phenotype, okay. And so we are doing some of those studies, but it's early days. But you can understand why, you know, people don't necessarily do that kind of thing. If you inactivate a gene in a young mouse and it has no phenotype, well, you might not go much further with it.
All right. Last few questions. And I'm curious, what even got you interested in studying cancer and aging in the first place?
So, I mean, I was trained in cancer. I always worked in cancer centers. I did my PhD at what was the Imperial Cancer Research Fund in London, now Cancer Research UK. I then went to Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. I worked with Bill Kalin, who subsequently went on to get a Nobel Prize for, you know, for oxygen sensing. I mean, he was looking at this specifically in the context of kidney cancer. I didn't work on any of that. I was working on different things, but it was, you know, really, I guess, you know, really exciting time to witness mm-hmm. that stuff. And I'm really happy for Bill to have got that. I worked with Bill Kalin at the Dana-Farber. I then had my own lab at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. And that was when I actually got drawn into cell senescence. So we were actually working on the HER-A chaperone, and that drew us into cellular senescence. The interesting thing about senescence is that, you know, as I said at the beginning, okay, senescence both prevents cancer but promotes aging. Okay, so that kind of got me thinking about, you know, both sides of it. I wrote a grant on senescence and I sent it to an NIH study section, which was primarily an aging study section, and the grant got funded. And then, as they do, they then, you know, ask you to come and, you know, come onto that study section and review grants. That tends to happen. So that was my first real kind of exposure to, you know, the biology of aging back mm-hmm. in the 1990s. And, you know, to start with, I thought, wow, this is, you know, really kind of crazy stuff, okay? Because the thing about aging is that it's, you know, it's so complex, it affects everything. And, you know, so you get exposed to all different types of biology, of different cells, of different tissues and different organisms. I mean, the breadth of it is just huge. So, you know, first time you start thinking about it, it's just kind of overwhelming. But then eventually, you know, when I started kind of getting to grips with it, you come to appreciate that, because, you know, just the complexities of it and the breadth of it and the fact that it's always connected to biology. Okay, I mean, sometimes, for example, if you work on epigenetics, sometimes you find yourself studying, you know, modification of a histone. Okay, but, well, okay, great. But what's that got to do? What's that really got to do with biology? But the thing about aging is, because it's fundamentally a biological process, okay, you know, everything always comes back to the biology. So if you like biology, I think, you know, aging is just the best thing, because it's always connected to the biology and it encompasses, you know, every different type of biology. Okay, so I really enjoy that. So yeah, it just kind of sucked me into it, and over the years I've got more and more interested in the biology of aging. But because I've always been, you know, because I was trained in cancer and always working in cancer centers, I then, you know, got thinking about this, well, you know, why does the incidence of cancer increase with age? Okay, I read a couple of very, you know, very influential to me anyway, articles by James de Gregory and João Pedro de Magalhães. They were previously thinking about the relationship between aging and cancer. So that kind of got me thinking about it more. And I realized that, you know, we really don't understand why the incidence of cancer increases with age. Okay. I mean, the view in the cancer field is often that, well, you know, cancer increases with age just because, you know, mutations accumulate with age, and it takes time to accumulate the number of mutations that you need to get cancer. And I think that's part of it. But, you know, when you look at it from a kind of hallmarks of aging perspective, you also realize, well, that's, you know, that's way too simple, okay? Because, you know, DNA mutations is only one of the hallmarks of aging, yeah? I mean, there's many of these hallmarks. So, and we know that most of these hallmarks, well, obviously all these hallmarks are changing with age. We know that many of them can probably contribute to cancer. So I think it's reasonable to propose that it's actually all of the hallmarks which are contributing to the increased incidence of cancer with age. And, you know, so that's what we're trying to get at with the grant that I mentioned on liver cancer. Okay, we're trying to take a broad view and look of lots of different things with collaborators at, you know, Salk Institute and UCSD.
That's fantastic that you combine your two interests.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a long time. For me anyway, it took a long time in biology to kind of get something which really kind of, you know, gets you excited and that you're really passionate about. But yeah, biology of aging and, you know, the relationship between aging and cancer is just really, really fascinating, I think.
Right. So many open questions. Amazing. So last question. Anything else on just cellular senescence, cancer, aging that we haven't covered you think you want to talk about?
Just a couple of areas. I mean, something that we're getting very interested in, the relationship between development and aging. Okay, so typically we think of development and aging as being two separate processes. Okay, you know, when development stops as a young adult, that's kind of when aging starts. I think we're starting to think of those as perhaps being more connected, and I know others are too. Vadim Gladyshev, for example, at Harvard. The reason we think this, and actually I won't go into it in detail, but it came out of some studies that we were doing with the HER-A chaperone, but it got us thinking that, you know, when you think about aging, and for example, you know, aging of stem cells, for example, those stem cells which are aging and leading to decline of a tissue, I mean, those stem cells were actually generated during development, okay, in humans, in, you know, in utero, okay? So there is a connection between development in utero and aging, okay? And what happens in utero and during early development, I mean, that is really the foundation for the aging that, you know, that's the foundation on which, you know, aging in later life happens, okay? So we're trying to kind of exploring that connection. To what extent does the integrity of, you know, early development in utero, to what extent does that influence late life aging?
Is this connected at all to the hyperfunction or the programmatic theory that David Gems or Joao Pedro talk about?
Yeah, possibly. And I listened to the, I don't think it has to be. Okay. I mean, I think it kind of, it does obviously kind of beg those kinds of connections. But I don't think, you know, I don't think it's necessary. I mean, I think regardless of, you know, whether you, you know, agree or disagree with the hyperfunction theory, okay, you know, I think it's still true that, you know, what happens in aging is happening on a foundation that was built during development. Okay, so I think therefore, you know, what happens in development should influence what happens in aging. I don't think that's a restatement of the hyperfunction theory, and it's not going as far as the hyperfunction theory. And I actually thought that, I think I misunderstood the hyperfunction theory a bit. I actually think that what, you know, kind of what, how David described the hyperfunction theory as being a, you know, kind of a, I mean, it's not a program as in, you know, aging is programmed, but it's a program as in, you know, it's something that happens just because of the way the biological system is set up. Okay. I mean, we've thought about some histone, you know, changes in chromatin. You know, some changes in chromatin with age, we think are happening, to, you know, the way they do, simply because, you know, this is the way they start. Okay. The way it starts is, you know, influences kind of what happens in later life. And, you know, so by that view, I mean, there is a bit of a program there. Yeah. I mean, it's programmed to start with, so that program is going to initiate, kind of influence what happens later. So I don't know, that's probably not really the hyperfunction theory.
When you say the way it starts, then would it be very connected to someone's genes, just like the genetics they get from their ancestors, or is there something that's happening super early on in life, even in just development stage, or maybe when the child is in the womb itself, that you think is affecting how people age later?
Yeah, so there is evidence, for example, that, you know, in utero influences, you know, for example, through mm-hmm. through diet, can influence late life aging. I mean, the so-called Dutch hunger winter, okay, when there was a famine at the end of the Second World War in the Netherlands, and you know, people who were in utero at the time of that famine, you know, 70 years later, there are increased risk of metabolic disease and obesity. Okay, so that's an example of how I think in utero programming, perhaps epigenetic programming, you know, in utero can influence late life aging. So that's the kind of mechanism that we're thinking about. Okay, which is exciting because it does, you know, it does then lead to the idea that, well, you know, you could have, you know, nutritional supplements, dietary supplements during, you know, during pregnancy to you know, promote health, you know, healthy development in a way that, you know, leads to, you know, healthy aging 70 years later. Okay, right. That's quite an intriguing idea, I think.
Yeah, it puts a lot more pressure on the mother.
Yeah, right. You're the first person that's picking up on that. I always hesitate to say that because it obviously does. But you know, I guess. You know, I'm just kind of, again, I guess I'm just reasoning through the science and not trying to think of the
no,
kind of...
No, absolutely. I mean, I think as long as we understand the explanations in science, and it's better for everyone, right, to just know what's actually happening then.
Right.
And I'll actually be talking to Dr. Vadim in like a few weeks as well.
Oh, great.
So I'm excited to talk about this then.
Yeah. Just the other thing, I just want to say one other thing, which is kind of getting me excited, which mm-hmm. and I think it's going to be a challenge for the field, is you know, heterogeneity associated with aging. Okay, so there's a number of papers out there now showing that, you know, as tissues age, they become, you know, more heterogeneous. Okay, the cells become, you know, more kind of divergent. I think the first person to show this was Jan Wick, Albert Einstein, quite a long time ago. He showed that cardiomyocytes in the heart, you know, in a young mouse, they're very similar. But in an old mouse, they become more divergent. Okay, so you get this heterogeneity with age. And with some of the technologies that we have now, that's becoming, you know, there's more and more studies are showing that. And so I think the implications of that for healthy aging, for aging, are really quite profound. Okay, I mean, how does that impact aging of a tissue? And experimentally, how do we investigate that? Okay, how do we kind of manipulate that heterogeneity and try and understand whether it's a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. It's going to be a challenge, I think, but it's a kind of an interesting problem to think about.
Is there any research on that, linking that with aging?
No. And I mean, there's not that I know of. There's now many studies showing that with age, that, you know, the transcriptome and the epigenome become more variable with age. Okay, I think Vadim has done some of that. Okay, so cells become more variable, but actually showing that, you know, understanding how, if it does, that actually contributes to tissue aging and decline in function, I don't know of anything. And as I say, I think it's a kind of a difficult problem to address, but an interesting one to think about.
Definitely. All right. Well, fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today. I'm looking forward to some of the more research coming out, some of the more open questions you're exploring.
Yeah. Thanks, Asta. Really, really nice talking to you.
And you as well.
Yeah. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I'm blown away by the pace of longevity research, and I want to keep bringing you great conversations with longevity scientists themselves. If you want to support all my effort and time that goes into the creation of this information to boost longevity, all resources can be found at livelongerworld.com. As you all know, aging is universal, and we can unite in this fight and soon be healthy forever. I can't wait, and see you next time.